Case number 206434, Jeremiah Waldrop et al. Versus City of Johnson City, Tennessee. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Marquise, you may proceed for the appellants.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
We've presented multiple grounds for error in the district court in this case. The first is a procedural argument that the district court ruled on an argument that was not raised below without giving notice under Rule 56.
Well, can I ask a procedural question just to make sure I'm getting this? Why is this case not moot? I mean, it seemed like the litigation was mainly about this one parade / event, and that's come and gone. Tell me why it's not moot.
Well, as we've set forth in the complaint, the plaintiffs, in this case, Mr. Waldrop and Mr. Self, preach on numerous occasions. They intend to, and they have plans to continue to preach in the city in the future. And based on what happened in this particular
case. But, I mean, has the city said they're not going to let them preach on a Sunday or a Monday or just walking through the park? That's not in the record, is it?
Well, I don't think the city has told them we're not going to let you preach, but I think based on what happened in this particular case, they can expect the same issue to happen again. And I think the same thing was in the Parks case, the same thing was in the McGlone case, similar issues.
What's the evidence that they're going to preach when it's not an LGBTQ event?
Well, we set forth in the complaint history of previous preaching events. Now, they weren't all LGBTQ events, but they're special events. And again, this is based on special events committee policy and policy implemented at this particular event. I don't think it has to be an LGBTQ event. I think any special event.
So I don't have the complaint in front of me. Does it just say, like, we want to preach at five? Does it identify the other events? Does it say there's this event on this day and this event on that day, and it's one that hasn't come and gone?
Well, we don't give specific dates and specific events. But again, based on their history and their assertions that they intend to preach in the future, and again, based on their experience at this particular event, they can expect.
Have they ever had a similar experience at another event? So they've been at other events.
There have been other events. They talk about the
But have they ever had the same experience?
Similar experience, yes. And
shut down, couldn't speak.
Well, yeah. So, or at least removed, or their speech restricted. And again, in this particular case, it's a public event. It's open to the public. It's in a traditional public forum.
Were those other cases? In those other cases, was there a designated speech zone? I mean, that's sort of one of the issues.
I don't believe so. And I would argue that doesn't solve the problem anyway. Setting aside a particular area for speech, if it's a public event and it's open to the public and it's in a traditional public forum, which was the case here, they have just as much right as anyone else to come and go in the festival in the permitted area as anyone else and to express a message.
What if it's a limited public forum?
Well, if it's a limited public forum, I guess you have it's a different case. It's intermediate scrutiny, but as we argued, intermediate scrutiny, this case doesn't satisfy, the restriction on their speech doesn't satisfy intermediate scrutiny either. There's not a significant government interest, and the completely removing them from the forum is not narrowly tailored to serve that interest.
While you're talking about procedural matters, we've got this Rule 56F issue that you highlighted, that the district court granted summary judgment to the city on an argument that was not advanced by either party.
Correct.
You read the briefs, both sides are arguing that there were issues of fact, issues over this Atkins declaration, over the Lyons deposition, over Captain Rice's 30B testimony, and you ask in the alternative that we reverse and remand because of all these factual disputes and because of this Rule 56F issue. Should we just go ahead and, why shouldn't we go ahead and grant your alternative request and just remand this matter, further proceedings, give the district court a chance to take another shot at this?
Well, Well, first of all, there's no dispute as to the issue that was the question of fact that was at issue, which is, were they removed from the festival because they were blocking the entrance or based on the content of their speech? The city concedes. In fact, they open their brief. They agree with us that the district court shouldn't have ruled on that factual finding. And that
But Judge Cole's saying, okay, fine. Is the answer just to send it back to the district court judge to start over? Well, or is it better, or is the preference to resolve the summary judgment motion here and now and decide whether there was a constitutional violation?
Well, because there's no dispute, an issue can't be disputed if nobody disputes it. So there's nothing to remand for. What's before this court is a legal question. The operative facts are not in dispute. And I would follow this court's lead in the Sistrunk case. In that case, there was a non-constitutional issue, whether there was state action in that particular case. And this court noted, normally we would not reach a constitutional question if there's a non-constitutional basis to rule. This court held it would be an imprudent waste of judicial resources, was the language used, to remand based on this non-constitutional issue that wasn't fully developed when there's a fully developed constitutional issue before it. And I would argue the same thing here. There's no dispute as to the operative facts in this case. It's a question of law based on those facts.
So the constitutional question goes to why they were prevented from speaking. You think the request for declaratory judgment is still live, and I guess there were nominal damages sought. That's it? Only nominal damages, nothing more? Am I right about that?
Well, it's primarily the injunctive relief. They want to preach again.
I hear you, and I'm just saying, I'm trying to clarify, nothing more than nominal damages after that.
Correct.
Okay.
The undisputed operative facts are this, and again, in ruling on our motion for summary judgment, the court obviously reviews the facts in the light most favorable to the city. So give the city their best day. Give them their version of the facts. Their version of the facts are the city made the decision, the special events committee, which they agree is a policymaker for the city, made the decision to grant Tri-Pride complete control of access to the festival for any reason, including disagreement with the viewpoint of a particular message. Now, there's dispute as to whether the decision was made at that time, but at the end of the day, it doesn't change the outcome because the city policy that was implemented and enforced on the day of the festival was that Tri-Pride has the right to exclude based for any reason. And that's reflected in the training materials that were provided. The city admits that the city provided security for the event. The training that was provided to that security was given at the direction of the chief of police. And there's a PowerPoint presentation and written materials that reflect that they gave Tri-Pride control and authority to exclude.
Can I just clarify another feature of your claim or theory? In Monell claims, so this is the claim against the city, people often talk about failure to train. That's the classic Monell form of relief. And you go down that road by referring to that a lot. But I'm not entirely sure, given exactly how you just put it, that that's really what you mean. I would say this isn't a failure to train case. It's a train case, and you trained them on an unconstitutional policy.
Well, I think that's accurate. I think
so that's not failure to train. That's training a bad policy.
Well, I think it's both. The failure to train is typically the city didn't prevent a constitutional violation. They didn't provide enough guardrails.
So I guess it's a failure to train when you don't tell them how to avoid the constitutional violation, but surely it's a failure to train when you say, here's how to violate the Constitution.
Right. Well, we believe the city's actual instruction, their actual training, violated the Constitution. So it's primarily a First Amendment issue, a First Amendment violation on behalf of the city. It was city policy that day that Tri-Pride could exclude anyone they wanted for any reason. The failure to train, I think that's a lesser included offense, I guess.
Do you have a ratification theory, too, that under Monell, a different prong of Monell? Is that one of your arguments?
We didn't raise that argument. I think that's valid.
Judge Radler did.
Thank you.
Well, is that another reason that we should... if you're not pursuing the theory, that's fine. If you are pursuing the theory and you didn't raise it below, isn't that another reason to remand the case, if we're remanding the case on other grounds?
Well, I think there's sufficient grounds aside from that. I think they affirmatively...
So not following that theory. Putting ratification. Right. We don't worry about ratification.
Right.
We're only back to failure to train.
I didn't raise that below. It's undisputed. In fact, the city argues, it's part of their theory of the case, that Waldrop and Self were excluded based on the content of their message. It's also undisputed that the removal was affected by city police officers in uniform acting under color of law in pursuant to city policy that was enacted and enforced that day. That's a constitutional violation. That's Parks, it's Bible Believers, Sage, McGlone. This case is very similar to the McGlone case. The difference in McGlone was there was an exclusive permit, and there was actually a ticketed area, but the area where McGlone and Peters were standing was permitted but open to the public. Well, that's all of Founders Park here. It's permitted and open to the public. The fact that the exclusion was at the behest of the permittee doesn't absolve the city. That's the same thing in Parks. It's the same thing in McGlone. It was pursuant to city policy that Waldrop and Self were allowed to be excluded based on the content of their...
Would this case be different if all there happened to be was a parade?
Well, there's not evidence that our...
Hypothetical. So just if everything else is the same except that it stopped after the parade. I mean, the event was a parade and that's that.
Well,
Would that change things?
If Waldrop and Self were attempting to share their message along the parade route, I think it would be the same issue. And I think the court in Hurley pointed out there's clearly a difference between trying to march in the parade and protesting along the parade route. So if they were sharing their message along the parade route, I think it would be the same case. And I want to point out the Adkins Declaration, because that we don't need the Adkins Declaration. The city doesn't dispute the reason that they were removed. We're clearly under Parks. There's no content neutral reason for excluding. And as this court in Parks said, it's difficult to conceive of a reason other than the content of their message. That's definitely true here, especially when the city comes right out and says that's why they were removed.
Is your failure to train claim, however it's characterized, it's just based on this one line in one PowerPoint? In other words, you're not saying there was a series of bad trainings over the years, or?
That's correct, and I think
and that's enough.
Based on the Pembauer case, there can be one. It can be based on one decision by a decision maker, and clearly here, the training that was provided.
Well, decision
that day,
by decision maker. That sounds more like ratification. Or it was one line and one PowerPoint on one day of training that your case hinges on.
Correct. And that was at the direction of the chief of police, and the city was providing security, and this is the instruction that was provided to that security.
And if there are other parts of that PowerPoint that are accurate and are consistent with the First Amendment, how is the court weigh those?
Well, I don't think there's anything that justifies the removal in this particular case. There are other ancillary points in the PowerPoint that we don't challenge, but giving them authority to remove based on any reason, including viewpoint, not just content, but viewpoint of the message, is a violation of the First Amendment.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll hear from the city. Morning.
Good morning. Eric Heron, member of the Tennessee Bar. Let me start by pointing out that the plaintiff's theory of municipal liability in the district court was limited to a failure to train under City of Canton v. Harris. It was only in their reply brief that it first appeared that they were making an argument under policymaker, and the Special Events Committee of the city was the policymaker, and that the directive there was liability.
I think they sort of conceded that this morning.
Yes. So,
but I mean, but this is a little semantic to me. What does a failure to train claim mean? Normally, it means something like you're supposed to teach somebody that a chokehold's bad, right? So that's it's the failure emphasis in the sense they didn't do any training.
Yes.
But if you have training that is bad, like how to violate the Constitution, that's still a failure to train problem in a different sense. It's training failures.
It you can conflate those two, but it was clear in the argument below that it was a failure to train.
But they're relying on the... It's a failure to train claim relying on this PowerPoint, which is to say a failure to train claim that says, here's how we violate their constitutional rights. They may not have said it that way, but that's what it did.
Well, okay, that goes to the merits of the First Amendment claim.
Let's talk about a chokehold case. What would you say the way to think about a chokehold case is when
you
have a training session that says, if you have somebody that's mouthing off and a real pain in the neck, here's the best way to make them feel miserable.
Right, or deadly force.
So what is that? Can we call that a failure? Can't the city be liable?
If it is a very obvious need for that type of training on that issue, what we're really looking at is deliberate
indifference. I don't think you're getting my point.
I'm sorry.
I'm imagining a very strange thing. This didn't happen. It's a hypothetical. But the city has a training session that says if you have somebody who's mouthing off, they're really obstreperous, they're obstructing justice, you want to inflict pain, here's the kind of chokehold to use. Okay? And the chokehold they're proposing violates the Eighth Amendment.
Yes.
You have failure to train liability, don't you?
For that example, here? Dealing with a conflicting First Amendment expressive messages. The street preachers clearly had a First Amendment expressive message, but so did TriPride. And so the decision was made by the city's policymaker that TriPride would be able to restrict access to the festival area. That was the decision that was made.
As a public forum,
but there are clear cases where when you have those competing expressive messages, the permit holder tips in the balance of control. And so let's keep in mind, in distinguishing these cases used by the plaintiffs, that they're not expressive message cases. Parks is their favorite case versus City of Columbia. An art festival, there was no expressive message. There was no interference either by the person handing out leaflets. They were excluded, obviously, for no other reason than the event organizer wanted them out of there. But here you've got TriPride clearly with an expressive message of inclusion, equity, diversity, all of that. And so here the street preachers were removed about 10 feet to a public sidewalk, still within the permitted area of TriPride's permit, and allowed to preach for hours.
The theory that First Amendment rights are mitigated or disappear if there's someone else with First Amendment rights? Is that your theory?
No, but the street preachers...
That's what you're saying is how you distinguish parks.
The street preachers' First Amendment rights are not superior to anybody else's, and so the City of Johnson City had this balance.
But why shouldn't it be just the opposite? As long as there's no actual interference, obstruction, when you have two speakers, the First Amendment's even more in play.
Well, I think there's videos submitted here that clearly indicate, and the verbiage gets difficult with the cases, of whether it's an attempt to participate in TriPride's message or interfering with TriPride's message or disrupting TriPride's message. But clearly they were allowed to communicate with their intended subject, the attendees of that festival. Clearly from the videos, there's no argument from those videos what was taking place, and there's no argument as to the degree of movement of about 10 feet of these preachers up to a public sidewalk, still within the footprint of the festival. Let me address, before I run out of time, the issue of continued efforts by the street preachers to preach in the future. Not only has that subject come up, Mr. Waldrop has preached in the streets of Johnson City after the TriPride event in 2019. He also testified.
Do you think this dispute is moot? Because they seek nominal damages, right? So that would keep it alive, but then the question is whether there's still a reason for an injunction going forward. What's your view of that?
Well, my first view is I think that you have the opportunity to affirm the trial court's opinion without reaching the First Amendment issues if you want, because the municipal liability argument.
The district court was wrong.
I'm sorry?
I thought you agreed that the district court's theory was mistaken. So how would we affirm that?
Well, he is not mistaken on the municipal liability argument. He found that it was factually unsupported, this failure to train, or that the city had deliberate indifference as to this training argument, which was the only argument presented in the summary judgment motion. And so on that lack of municipal liability, this court has the opportunity to affirm the lower court without addressing the merits of the First Amendment claim.
You're defending the training or lack of training or incorrect training that was given?
I'm just saying that there was no deliberate indifference. Factually, what the plaintiffs...
You're arguing the district court was correct in denying Monell liability. And the district court... So how do we tease that? How do we tease out... There's a line in the PowerPoint that seems inconsistent with accepted First Amendment principles. Do you agree or disagree?
I think all these First Amendment cases turn on the factual basis. And so on the failure to train, the weakness of their argument on the failure to train is that they were relying on disputed facts instead of relying on interpreting facts most favorable to the non-movement.
Well, that's a reason to not grant them summary judgment.
Correct.
But that's not a reason to grant you summary judgment.
Our theory of the summary judgment really was to address the municipal liability issue, that failure to train did not have the value needed, and Judge Greer was correct. We did advance First Amendment on the merits argument that TriPride had control of the forum properly because it had its own expressive message. And
I guess if we disagree on the First Amendment, I don't know what it means to not have the value needed, but one way to figure out what the value needed, I don't know what that means, but one way to address that would just be to remand it back to the district court to figure out whether there's Monell liability here.
We don't see a need for remand. We think the trial court should be sustained on the lack of municipal liability.
Because there's no constitutional violation, or because even if there is a constitutional violation, there's no Monell liability? And if it's the latter, I just don't follow the argument.
I think there's a lot of factual dispute on the First Amendment issues.
Which can cut both ways. Do you want a ruling on this or not?
I do, yes, I do.
So just to make sure I'm understanding, the request for nominal damages would allow this to go forward even though the key event has already taken place. In their complaint, they say they were denied an opportunity to speak at this one parade based on content, but then they say they want to preach in future events. What does the record show on the future events? Are they really there? What does the record show?
The record shows that Mr. Waldrop, not necessarily Mr. Self, he couldn't remember, but Mr. Waldrop did preach in 2019, the year after. It was not a TriPride festival.
Without any restrictions?
Without restrictions, no, wasn't molested, wasn't arrested, wasn't anything. In fact, his testimony was he has preached every Blue Plum Festival from 2011 forward, and that he agreed that most of the time the police are protecting him. And we've cited to the record
his
testimony.
That would suggest the request for injunctive relief is moot.
Yes. There is no need for injunction in this case.
But you'd still have the nominal damages as to the city Monell point.
And I'm
you
sorry.
Want you'd still have the question of whether the nominal damages and whether the constitutional violation occurred, and we've already heard you say you want us to rule on that in terms of whether there's Monell liability or not.
I think that's correct, yes. It's a nominal damages issue at most. This is an academic discussion over how to handle competing expressive messages.
Do you want to end on an academic discussion? There's got to be a higher note.
I think it is an academic discussion, as a lot of these First Amendment cases are. But let me distinguish for you McGlone, which was handled by the plaintiff's counsel in Nashville, Tennessee. It was a gay rights festival. And the problem there was that the city of Nashville moved the street preachers in that case outside, a street over, actually a operational street, moved the preachers to a sidewalk outside of the festival area where they were trying to preach over the top of traffic, and they were not within the permitted area. Here, there's no doubt that these street preachers, based on Captain Rice's directive and decision and judgment, that they could remain on the sidewalk on the very edge of Founders Park, but there was a closed street behind them. It was all a part of Tri-Pride's permit that the preachers stayed in and preached for the estimate of 4 additional hours. And we provided their own videotapes of their preaching, where there is all kinds of engagement between the street preachers and the attending participants to that festival. There's no doubt that they had this avenue of communication remaining for them. But the question becomes, were they trying to participate or alter the message of Tri-Pride? Were they interfering with Tri-Pride, or were they disrupting Tri-Pride? If any of those things, then the movement of 10 feet off a grassy strip of land in front of the sidewalk to move them back to the sidewalk was not a First Amendment violation of their free speech. They continued to speak. It also should be known that in the record, Mr. Self, before he met up with his colleagues to preach with amplification, I might add, was distributing literature within the Festival of Tri-Pride, just walking about. Nothing happened to him. He had no encounter. There was no...
Distributing literature is okay, but verbally saying something...
Well, if it interferes with the message,
Wouldn't the leafleting interfere with the message?
There was no...
Contrary message?
Arguably it could, but I'm just giving you the facts that to distinguish it with Parks. You know, here's Parks. He gets removed for distributing literature in an artist event that had no expressive message. Here's Tri-Pride, who did want it open to the public, but they did not. They did have their own special message that they were entitled to convey.
Back to make sure I'm understanding one part of your case. So your view on Monell is, listen, all they raised was a failure to train claim.
Correct.
And you say we win on that because there was training. That's your basic argument. Am I getting it right? That as long as there's training, never have a failure to train claim.
We're not saying it was a briefing of what the special events committee had directed about the control, but there was no deliberate indifference shown factually about this failure to train. That's the standard, and it's an exacting standard according to the U.S. Supreme Court.
And the reason you win is that they did try to train? Is that your point? As long as you try to train, you can't have a failure to train? Is that your point?
No, sir.
Your point is what they did in the training wasn't deliberately indifferent. That's the way you would put it? I'm not trying to trick you. I'm trying to make sure I'm getting your distinction.
I'm not sure there was what would be called training. There was a briefing the morning of the festival directing the officers. Tri-Pride has rented the Founders Park, and they can restrict who enters the park. Now, obviously, there's an overlap of a lot of security. We had 200 officers in this event to try to, based on social media and everything else, of threats. Keep in mind the security and the expressive message of Trap Ride are the different sides of the same coin, but for the need for security indicates that Trap Ride had an expressive message.
The different sides of the same coin, and the coin is the First Amendment.
I agree.
Oh, we're on the same page. All right, I think we'll hear rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. First, I want to point out, clearly we have more than just a failure to train claim. If it was only a failure to train claim, we would only have a 14th Amendment due process claim. We brought First Amendment claims. So I think, as I mentioned earlier, an affirmative training to violate the Constitution is a First Amendment violation. So it was never just failure to train. And I want to circle back to Parks was a preliminary injunction case. And I don't recall in Parks there being any discussion of mootness or whether there was future plans to preach. The court found, based on the question of injunctive relief, that there was a violation, and the court ruled in favor of the plaintiffs in that case. So here, I don't think there's a question of mootness, and at any rate, there's allegations in the complaint that they plan to preach in the future.
But he says the record shows that there have been no restrictions since this event.
Well, again, they agree that they argue that the Blue Plum Festival doesn't have the same, doesn't have an expressive message, and LGBTQ or Pride events do. Well, Waldrop and Self are happy to preach at the Blue Plum Festival, but if they want to preach at a future Pride Festival or any type of festival that has what would the city would argue a discernible message, they're going to run into the same problem that they did at this festival. So their preaching ability is still curtailed.
But I mean, who cares if you know, why are you worried about that if the nominal damages claim against the city is still live? It sounds like both sides want us to rule on the Monell point. If you get a ruling on that, what's there to worry about? The city's on notice. It would be pretty easy to get a future injunction if you needed it. I just don't understand why it matters.
I think we have grounds for an injunction in this case, and I think we've set that forth. And again, based on Parks, I think this court is in a position to rule in our favor on that point. Thank you.
All right, thanks to you for your both of you for your briefs and for your arguments, and thanks as always for answering our questions. Appreciate it. The case will be submitted, and the clerk may call the last case.